The Oxford Sparks Podcast, Episode 3, There's No Place Like Home, Part 2.
So up to about 10,000 years ago, there were no humans in the British Isles.
The reason being that before this, the British Isles were covered in ice, but...
the ice started to move back, and then hunter-gatherers moved in and started populating the British Isles from the continent. As time went on, then agriculture came in. That changed the dynamics, could hold higher population densities. Then you have the ancient British, then you have the Romans came in. Probably didn't come in huge numbers, but their culture made a huge impact. After them, then you get the Anglo-Saxons coming in, and there's a big debate whether they were in big numbers or not. Then you get the Vikings, Norse Vikings and Danish Vikings, who are probably separate people. So the Danish Vikings came into the east, probably from similar places where the Anglo-Saxons came in. So culturally they were very different people, but genetically probably the same. They're only 200 years later.
This is Bruce Winnie.
I'm a population geneticist, and I run the People of British Isles project.
Bruce and his team are collecting data on the genetic makeup of the British Isles, primarily to aid medical research into understanding how genetics can influence disease.
So when we first started, we were doing things called association studies. And association studies, you had a group of patients with a disease, group of people without, we call them a control population, and you look for genetic differences between them. So something that's more often found in the patients is likely to be associated with the susceptibility to that disease. So if we can match the controls to the patients with their genetic background, that will hopefully get rid of some of the noise caused by the population structure. This is probably where the next few years are going.
Essentially, Bruce is grouping people from across the UK by their genetics. But there's a really exciting side effect of doing all of this work. As a result of uncovering the subtle genetic differences across the British Isles, the team are hoping to look at how much of an effect early settlers had on the population of today. We're used to history being handed down by accounts, by records, and from archaeological evidence. But could population genetics open up a new window into Britain's past?
We were hoping that genetics will tell you the history of the people, because history generally tells you the history of the powerful people, the winners, the small elites, whereas the genetics should tell you the history of the peasants, the farmers, everybody else.
By comparing their data to the historical record, the team hope that they'll be able to match up early movements with genetic differences that they've found between different populations across the UK. But before any of this could happen, they needed a lot of carefully collected samples, spanning the whole of the British Isles. After 6 years of effort, they've collected samples from 3,500 people.
First thing's probably one of the most important things when you're doing this is actually to get a good sample collection. It's easy to go out and just recruit a load of people, but if you don't characterise them properly and collect the right set of samples, you don't get the right set of data coming out. So it's a sort of classic rubbish in, rubbish out. So most important thing we do first of all is identify, this, in this case for human subjects, we identify people who fit our criteria, and in this case it's particularly four grandparents born in the same rural area, which is quite hard to do. That meant we knew that the people probably had a good family history from the area, they're probably good representatives. So that was a good quality data in.
Just think about the people you know. Do any of them have four grandparents all from the same rural area? But finding those people is important if the team are to detect these subtle differences. Once they'd managed to find people who fit the study criteria, they collected blood samples.
So we take the DNA from the blood samples and we look at genetic differences between them. And we use this genetics to try and group people genetically into groups. And then we look to see how these genetic groups, are they geographically differentiated to each other or are they all in the same place?
So the things Bruce and his team are looking for in the DNA samples are called genetic markers. These are sequences found on a particular chromosome, but for which it's possible to carry one of two different versions, or even both versions.
So traditionally for genetics, for these population studies, a lot of people have looked at one genetic marker or two, the Y chromosome or the mitochondrial DNA. But that is a very small part of the genome, and what you're then looking at is the history of that really, really small part. We want to look at the history of the whole genome. So we type them for about 1 million markers across the whole genome. And after quality control, we end up with something like 600,000 genetic markers.
So population geneticists such as Bruce use these to look at the variation between individuals and between populations. After all of that work, they can then group people together using these genetic markers, allowing them to categorize people within a population solely on their genetics.
When you're looking at humans, particularly if you're looking at humans in, say, within Europe or within the UK, which is what we're doing, you really can't separate populations by a single genetic marker, because to detect these very, very, very small differences that you find in the UK, you need large, carefully collected sample size for individuals, and you also need to look at quite a lot of genetic markers as well to come up with the subtle differences.
So Bruce and his team took all these genetic groups of people and plotted them on a map of the British Isles.
I mean, it was literally jaw-dropping at the time when the first maps came out. We had no expectation it'd be so clean. I mean, these groups are really tight. It's really difficult to explain. I mean, you spend a lot of time collecting the samples. It took 6 years to collect the samples, a year to get the data, a year or so to analyse it. And after all that work, and just to come up, it was just stunning.
So what did it look like?
First of all, you get a big group in South and Central England. So it goes from Somerset across to Kent and Sussex, up including East Anglia to the sort of South Yorkshire and across to Shropshire and the Welsh borders. That is one group that we can never, ever split up. It's a big group. We've got about 850 samples in there. So that says that people have moved around in that a lot. So they go to Lincolnshire or East Anglia, and they're really proud of their local roots and how different they are to the rest of the country. But I would say that if anyone from East Anglia tells you they're different from someone from Dorset, they're actually wrong. They're all in the same group. Genetically, we can't differentiate them. Suggests there's been a lot of movement around.
Well, let's skip across to Devon, where I'm from. We're always very keen, us Devonians, to say we're definitely not Cornish, but we're also a bit different from the English. What about the genetics?
And in fact, there is a group that sits on the Devon almost perfectly. There's about 6 individuals outside the Devon county boundaries. So they are genetically different to people in Dorset and Cornwall. And when Anglo-Saxons came in, you get Anglo-Saxon archaeology into Devon, but not into Cornwall. And it's sort of, yeah, socio-political boundaries for a lot of things like that is my guess. I expected we might find some north-south differences, some east-west differences. You might find Wales maybe different to England. But to find Cornwall different from Devon, different from the west of England, to find north of Wales different from south of Wales, to find the northern islands in Orkney different to the southern islands in Orkney. I mean, that, it was just almost unbelievable at the time. I mean, we really had to pinch ourselves. It was brilliant.
But of course, all this complexity just raises new questions, and there's a load more work to do. It's hoped that as the study progresses, they might even be able to use the data in combination with archaeological evidence or even with historical records to generate a clearer picture of our ancestry and provide a more powerful lens on the past.
We are looking at people now to try and see what happened in the past. So we've got these different genetic groups in the UK. What we'll be able to do, once the techniques and things are up and running and in place properly, and people are beginning to try and do this, right, let's go to back to some Anglo-Saxon graves, or pre-Roman graves, Romano-British graves. What do they look like? Do they look like what we see now, or do they look at something different? Was the population structure slightly different? It's by doing this sort of work that we will then be able to differentiate or work out how big an effect the Anglo-Saxons had on this, for instance, the southeast group. Because if the Romano-British graves samples look like what we see now, that would suggest it was pre-Anglo-Saxon was really quite important. If they look different and the Anglo-Saxon graves look like what we see now, that would suggest that the Anglo-Saxon influence was the most important there. And hopefully, within the next decade or so, we should be able to answer some of these questions.
You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Chris Lintott, and produced by Ed Prosser. You can find a full list of credits and much else besides on our website at oxfordsparks.net.